Welcome, everyone. Tonight's talk is a continuation of our series that is exploring the chapters in my newest book, The Three Principles of Oneness. Tonight's reading will begin with Albert Einstein. A human being is part of the whole, called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts, and feelings as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. So in this chapter of my book, I go outside of the spiritual realm and the purely scientific realm. As you might recall from last week, we explored the origins of suffering using science and the current models that we have about the universe to form our foundation for then going into the practices of liberation. Tonight, we're going to explore some of the secular voices. Now, when I use the word secular, it's very important, as you know, to define your terms, because words are the fingers that shape the mind. So for me, the word secular comes from its root, which means of the age. So for me, secular literally just means that these are voices, these are ideas, or these are concepts that are coming from this current zeitgeist, this current period, this current age. Some people began to use secular as an opposition to spiritual. And while I understand what they're doing, I really don't like that because that creates another false duality. So when I'm using secular voices, what I'm saying is these are voices that are not coming from a particular spiritual tradition. Rather, these are voices coming from our own culture, our own age, our own understanding, and they too are pointing to the oneness of all life. So obviously, I won't go into all the details because I mentioned many folks in this chapter to help establish my thesis. And the first person is Edgar Mitchell. Edgar Mitchell was an astronaut who, while in space looking back at Earth, had a very powerful experience of oneness. And this experience of oneness that he had in outer space changed his life. And when he came back, he was forever different. And he took the energy that came from that experience, and he went on to create the Noetic Institute and other explorations, and really devoted his life from there out to see how we might, as a planet, as a people, wake up to our oneness. The next person I mention is Alan Lightman, who is a physicist, and he is also a beautiful writer, and he talks about his experience of oneness when he was sailing, having this powerful insight and experience of the oneness of all life. And he went further on in his writings after that experience to talk about the ways in which science sometimes has become dogmatic. And science itself has become established as a sort of religion where you can't question the orthodoxy, where if you do, you risk losing your job or your tenure or not being published. And so he is an interesting voice that I highly recommend, because he speaks both from this spiritual experience of oneness that he had, and he can speak so well and so intelligently in both the languages of science and spirit. The next person is Neil deGrasse Tyson, who many of you know from my interview with him and our conversations that he and I have had over the years. But he too is a great spokesperson for the idea of the oneness of all life. His experience came whenever he was just a boy and he visited the planetarium, and he felt called by the universe to speak of this glory, this majesty and wonder. And he continues to do so through his life and his practices and his shows, like the beautiful show Cosmos on television. Sam Harris is an American philosopher who was also a neurologist by background. He himself has had a powerful experience of oneness, a powerful experience of awakening, and he articulates how this awakening experience does not have to be only couched in terms that are familiar from a religious point of view, but that you can use everyday language to describe the power of this kind of experience. Andrew Newberg, who is probably the foremost proponent of what's called neurotheology, and that's the study of spirituality by using spec scans and special tools to be able to look at the changes that go on in the brain when people are meditating or they're praying. He has actually shown us physically what occurs when a person is in that state of oneness, and the changes, the very beneficial changes that go on in the brain when that happens. Tanya Singer, another neurologist that I talk about, she has shown us how oneness is something we're wired for. That the ideas that human beings come into this world and all we are these selfish, greedy little beasts intent only upon their own survival is a fiction. And that what we know from neurology and what we understand from physiology is that human beings are wired for connection. And actually, it's when we don't have that connection or we don't perceive that connection, that's when we get weird. That's when all the neurosis comes in. That's when all the problems occur. Greg Matloff, a physicist who is really pushing the edges of what in science is called panpsychism, which is that everything has a form of consciousness to it. He is currently exploring the idea that even planetary systems have a form of consciousness. And he will soon be able to reveal to us what he's learned. Bob Waldinger, who is a Buddhist minister and a longtime psychiatrist and teacher at Harvard University, showed in probably the biggest study on this subject that the happiness of human beings and even their normal longevity is largely due to this sense of connectedness that they have. The deeper that sense of interconnectedness, the deeper that embrace of oneness in their lives, the happier and the healthier they are and the longer that they will live. Bruce Alexander and his great study showed us that even things that we normally talk about in other ways, like addiction, that even addiction itself might come about and be undergirded by a sense of separation, even at a mammalian level. And I'm talking about mice here. That having that sense of belonging, that sense of connectedness itself may be a key to understanding the power of addiction. So all of these voices and others that I mentioned throughout this book are there to help us to know that this discussion, this idea, this concept, this experience of oneness is not something that belongs solely to people that would traditionally be called religious. It happens everywhere and at all times, and it always will. In last week's discussion, when I was laying out the view of how humans have evolved, one of the things that I mentioned was that this sense of separation that we felt from the cosmos, from each other, over time was tried to be healed by the creation of religious traditions. Now, when I'm saying this, I am in no way disrespecting or saying anything negative about any particular religious tradition. I'm just saying that I believe that man is homo religious. And so we naturally began to try to find a way to overcome this sense of separation. And this sense of that worked in different ways. But the basic problem of it was, is that there was always something that was standing between us and oneness, or us and God. And so laws and rules and religious observations were all about somehow bridging that gap. And when we look at the span of our history and how we look at each epoch and each period of time, what it shows us is that in some ways we are still reeling as a society of humans from the medieval period. Because you see, up to the time of the medieval period, and this is pretty much true around the globe, humans had a sense of belonging in the cosmos. What these religious systems had done for us is it placed us in a sense of belonging to the cosmos, that the heavens and the earth were made for us. And so we had this deep sense of belonging. And one of the things that I have discovered is that cosmology dictates anthropology. And anthropology dictates theology. Now, by theology, I don't mean a specific reference to a particular deity. I mean the study of divinity, the idea of the sacred. So think about that for a moment. Cosmology dictates anthropology, and anthropology dictates theology. So in the medieval period, the cosmology we had was that God had created the heavens and earth, whatever name God was given, and that we belonged to the cosmos. And that created an anthropology of relationship to the divine. And the theological teachings were there to help explicate and expound on that relationship. But then something happened. I believe around the 15th century through the 17th century. And that was the discovery of natural philosophy, which eventually would evolve into science. The Copernican Revolution began, where we were no longer the center. We realized that the universe, or the solar system at the very least, was heliocentric, not earth-centric. So what did that mean? It meant that we were being displaced. And once we began to be displaced in the cosmos, and this was further explicated by Galileo, we began to have that affect our anthropology. Because if we're not that important in terms of the cosmos, well, then perhaps we're not that important as a species. And in some ways, this was, albeit the wrong-headed way they handled it, the reason that the church and other established religious groups balked at these concepts. And we can certainly explore that history, and we can talk about power struggles and all those other things. But honestly, anytime that sort of thing occurs, whether it was back then or it's today, it's because it has some sort of existential impact. It's saying something about our existence. And what this did then was it made it even more difficult for our theological teachings and structures to try to understand how we had now been displaced. And then, of course, we have the plague that hits. And it's my own opinion and that of others that it was during this time where the religious approach to the plague was not helping whenever we were being blamed for what was going on or we were saying that God was cursing us. The change occurred through a combination of both religious and natural philosophers who began to say, well, maybe this isn't a curse from God. Maybe this is something that's happening in the natural world and we can understand it. And they combined, because remember, most of those people back then were also belonging to religious orders. So in other words, they weren't like secular like today where they had no connection to religion. They were usually coming out of some religious order. And those folks were saying, well, you know what? In the Bible, it says, you know, 40 days and 40 nights. Maybe what we should do is when new ships come into the harbor, we should make them sit there for 40 days and 40 nights, especially if they have anyone who is sick. And that, in fact, is what the word quarantine comes from. So you see, even then, it was not this separation that has come over time. So what I am suggesting is that we need a new mythos. I explored with you, and all of us are familiar with the old myths that we've grown up around. But I'm saying that I believe we need a new mythos. We need a mythos that is grounded in what we actually understand about the universe right now, and that grounding and how things work must be one with why things matter. And I actually believe that when we do not feel connected to the cosmos, and that creates bad anthropology, and that in turn causes a great struggle within theology, that we try to replace that. Remember, that separation, that gap, we're going to try to fill that up. And from an introverted sort of place, or extroverted rather, we will seek fame and fortune. We will seek status as a way to fill that up. And on a more introverted level, we will try to do the same by cutting ourselves off, by isolating. By falling into places of deep depression where we feel like there's nothing we can do. So that if I can't get the extroverted things, then the introverted world is meaningless. And you see this all the time. And I personally believe that this is the result, that this loss of having a spiritual and even a moral center happens because of this disconnection from our cosmology, which creates bad anthropology. So on the old myth, you had the idea that for many humans were just fallen sinners. And for the science side, well, we were just these creatures that evolved out of the desire to survive. and that we are just puppets for genomes. And I say to you that neither one of those views is based on what we actually know now, and neither one of those views will help us. Now, something is happening, and it happened at the end of the World Wars, and I don't think that that's an accident. We began to explore technology in a new way. And we saw the rise first of advances in the use of radios and electric technology, and certainly then atomic technology. But our real focus became on the creation of the computer and the creation of the ability to do things that we had never fathomed were possible. And this has led to the creation of a virtual world, a world where it exists almost as another universe. And we don't know how far this is going to go. If we don't die out for some natural reason, and if we continue to evolve, I think that this will be the next place we will go. And it will affect our evolution both physically and mentally. And that as we move more into this world we're experiencing here tonight, this virtual world that is online, I think that this is going to grow and grow and grow. And I think at some time within the next century, the idea of even the mind or the mental me being part of a machine, being part of some sort of automated, computerized technology, it will happen. People talk about this, it's a whole field of study called transhumanism, when the human and the machine will become a part of each other. We're already a part of each other. All you have to do is walk down the street and watch people on their phones. Anywhere you go, people have their head in their phones. And I'm not criticizing anyone. I'm just saying that this is the reality that we're living in. That virtual world is becoming more and more important to us, and I promise you, if we survive, it will be the next step in our evolution. Now, if that's so, and we haven't figured this other part out, I don't think it's going to be very good. I think if we haven't figured this part out, if for whatever reason we are still experiencing this great sense of separation, then we will just create a techno-religion, and they'll become some sort of computer god. And the duality that we live out of will continue. And whatever is stronger will be the one that conquers and goes on. And if we get good at making machines that are smarter, faster, and more capable than we are, it's our species that might go. So that's why not only is this something that's so important to wake up to now, but it's going to have waves of difference that will affect the future. And so that's why I've devoted my whole life to this. And I hope you will share this too. And as I said last time, evolution to me is a theory that shows how things work. And why it matters is because I believe this convergence of complexity creates consciousness. And consciousness is related to a form of protein consciousness or proto-consciousness that is actually the center and ground nature of the universe. We always talk about the difference between Newtonian and Einsteinian physics. And actually, I think instead of Einsteinian, we ought to call it Borean, because as much as Einstein was very wise and he offered us a lot of great insights with some of his theories, he resisted quantum
mechanics, and he really didn't like some of the things that it was showing. And I think Niels Bohr and the Copenhagen School actually are the ones that embraced this brave new world. But we still think we're living in a Newtonian world, but we're not. We're not living in that Newtonian world anymore. We are living in a world of the quantum. Soon we'll have quantum computers. So we have to wake up that this idea that we live in this Newtonian building block world where everything is only connected to each other through laws is only part of the picture. The deeper reality is that we are interconnected. We are one. And here's the last thing I want to say about tonight. In order for us to experience the fruits of awakening to the oneness of all life, science cannot be at the center of the equation. Now, let me clarify this. As you know, I love science. Science to me is knowledge. And I love learning. And we live in a golden age of understanding. And yet there are many mysteries yet we just don't fully understand. And perhaps even science will be replaced by some other form of knowledge at some point, as Carl Sagan suggested. But science is knowledge, and knowledge should never be at the center of any process or any format or program that we undertake. And here's why. Knowledge is not the same as wisdom. How things work, which we call science, is knowledge. And knowledge can be very powerful. But why things matter, that's wisdom. And in my opinion, true wisdom always is joined with compassion. If knowledge is at the center of this equation, then wisdom will not be heard. And I would go so far to say, as today, I think one of the biggest problems we have in our society is that we're constantly giving people knowledge. For heaven's sake, our brain size is shrinking slightly because we're, you know, some theorize we're requiring less memory now because we have so much at our fingertips. That's one theory of why that's happening. That the IQ level worldwide has actually risen since the 1920s, and yet the brain capacity size, the cubic centimeters, is actually shrinking. And some theorize it's because we're not using our minds the same way. It's a theory. But the idea is that if we don't have wisdom and we're just giving people knowledge, then we're not making fully alive human beings. It is my conviction that wisdom must be the thing that we emphasize along with knowledge. Not instead of knowledge, but along with knowledge. And here's why. Lots of folks believe that if you have intelligence, so you take some IQ test, which by the way, they have to update every 5 years because we are getting a little smarter. And if you take an IQ test from the 1930s, it's going to be a lot easier than one you take in 2000. People think that if you're smart and you have lots of knowledge, that somehow that makes you better. And while that might give you an advantage, lots of areas, it doesn't mean you're wiser. And it doesn't mean, by any stretch of the imagination, that you're more compassionate. You want proof of this? There was a very famous serial killer who both physically and mentally was a giant. He stood nearly 7 feet tall. And his IQ was somewhere around 145 to 150. Far higher than most human beings. And yet, this giant, both in physiognomy and in brain power, ended up to be one of those brutal, horrendous serial killers in history. Now, if you look at his story, you can say, well, there were lots of reasons why this happened to him. But the point is, it doesn't equate. So, just as I said last time, that yes, evolution for me is more than just an idea. It actually shows us how things work. And that's an idea that goes back, even in some ways, anticipated by the Buddhist tradition. And I believe that evolution has a purpose. And I called it sentient-centric. I believe that the universe's reason and the vehicle of evolution is the purpose is consciousness. And the primacy of consciousness is going to be the key to bring all this together. Because when you're trying to figure out a grand unified theory of everything, until you bring consciousness into the equation, it's not going to happen. So just as I believe that the purpose of evolution in our universe is consciousness, I believe that the primacy of consciousness and understanding how we think and how we believe and how, as the Buddha said, our thoughts create our experience. That insight, which is the basis of mindfulness, that's the spiritual evolution that we can be a part of. So, those are the ways in which secular voices can help us to experience boundless.